Harvard University has been looking for a new president since last May. That's when President Neil L. Rudenstein announced he's resigning. The names of the candidates have been kept mostly secret, though a hot local rumor had it for a while that William Jefferson Clinton might be interested. Our Allie Furlow graduated from Radcliffe College 50 years ago. That's before that small New England liberal arts college decided to admit women by acquiring Radcliffe and calling the whole academic shebang Harvard. Allie has been revisiting some of her haunts in Cambridge, trying to find out where Harvard is now headed and what kind of president is going to take it there.
Few of Harvard's 26 presidents have found the job easy. In 1769, Harvard President Edward Holyoake said, "If any man wishes to be humbled and mortified, let him become president of Harvard College." This presidency doesn't sound so terrible to me. It comes with a beautiful old house on Elmwood Avenue, just a brisk walk from Harvard Square, a yearly salary of at least $300,000, and the power to hire any professor you want to. But there must be a tribulation or two, or President Rudenstein wouldn't be resigning after only 10 years in office. He did take a three-month leave of absence in 1994 due to exhaustion. It must have been all that fundraising. In his more than 10 years at Harvard, the endowment has increased from $4.7 billion to more than $15 billion. The standards of the Harvard Corporation, who choose the president, are high. The letter from their search committee to all Harvard alumni says they're seeking a person of high intellectual distinction with proven qualities of leadership. Lewis Cabot is a former member of the Board of Overseers, whose family has given houses and libraries to Harvard and Radcliffe. He feels that the presidency of Harvard is one of the most important jobs in the world.
Where's the intellectual leadership going to come from that thinks about how mankind is going to survive in the next century? It's not going to come from government, and it's not going to come from the press. It's not going to come from business. The universities of this world, I think, are where it's going to come from. And Harvard's one of the greatest, if not the greatest, and the leadership of Harvard can be important to all of mankind.
The Reverend Peter Gomes, Harvard's plumber professor of Christian morals and Pusey minister in the Memorial Church, is a bit skeptical.
I've had that discussion with Louis Cabot. I couldn't disagree more profoundly. If you thought of the president of Harvard as a sort of in an intellectual pope whose empire transcends Cambridge and who is supposed to speak for the realm of ideas around the world, I think what that does is diminish the fact that there are qualities and opportunities that are required here in Cambridge and in Harvard College, which the president himself ought to be able to exercise. And if the president of Harvard is a good president of Harvard, in my opinion, people will want to know what the president of Harvard thinks, not because the president of Harvard is some international figure, but because the president of Harvard is president of a remarkable institution and is doing well helping that institution to sustain itself.
As for the students this president will be leading, or at least inspiring, just try and get one to cut even 10 minutes of a class to speak to a reporter. I did manage to track down the president of Harvard's student council, Fentress Driscoll. She's a government major, intending to go to law school after graduation and then into politics. We met briefly in between two of her classes downstairs in Harvard's majestic old Memorial Hall, where all sorts of activities were happening at once. We sat on the stairs leading up to the hall's theater. Are you a driven bunch of career-oriented maniacs? Because when I was your age, we would cut classes just to go and eat donuts with some good-looking guy. We didn't really get the greatest education, some of us. In my case, I acted in plays right in this very theater.
The time that you described when you were here seems like a much gentler, a much more fun and simpler time, whereas nowadays students are very academically driven, which I don't think is necessarily a bad thing. Our quest for truth and self-knowledge comes about through our other activities and our other organizations and just trying to strike that balance. but to the extent that Harvard upholds those old ideals, I don't feel that that filters down to the student body in the same way that maybe it did in decades past.
A Harvard student told the Boston Globe a few years ago, quote, "Harvard can be a pool of competitive piranhas, but that's how the real world is," unquote. Shouldn't your college years be the opposite of the real world? I put this question to Lewis Cabot.
I think that Harvard has made that choice quite a long time ago. Are they going to try to be the university for the best and the brightest and the most energetic? Or are they going to be a nice place for comfortable people to go from teenage to the next stage in life? And there's plenty of places in this country you can do that. If you're going to get the best and the brightest from all over the world, it's going to be competitive. If a young person doesn't want to be in a competitive world, then Harvard isn't the place for them.
Maybe the good old days weren't so very good, or at least not so seriously studious. Michael Burbank, a Cape Cod landscaper and artist, graduated in 1966. After loading some lilac branches onto his truck, he recalled some of his college days.
For example, the last and maybe first panty raid on Radcliffe emanated from my dormitory his freshman year in Harvard. And
you did not participate?
I refused to answer on the grounds it could incriminate me. But let's just say that I was fully aware of it. And it was quite a spectacle. The police were called in, and there were bunches of undergraduates running around with their trophies. A lot of Radcliffe girls were outraged.
Michael just missed the student revolution of 1968. They occupied the historic University Hall and nearly brought Harvard to a halt. Luckily for the new president, he or she probably won't have to deal with undergraduate behavior like that. Today's students are too busy getting all A's. Harvard costs them $35,000 a year. They must want their money's worth. But undergraduates won't be the president's only concern. Besides Harvard College, Harvard University has a law school, a medical school, a divinity school, a business school, a school of dental medicine, graduate schools of design, arts and sciences, and education, a school of public health, the John F. Kennedy School of Government, a famous art museum, and that $15 billion, the largest university endowment in the world. And Harvard is still fundraising. Peter Fuller, class of 1948, owner of a famous old Boston Cadillac dealership, responds to Harvard appeals this way.
When they hit me up, I always say to them, gosh, it seems to me that you folks have an awful lot of money and that I'd rather give the money to the Harvard wrestling team, where I had a great time, or perhaps to the fund that remembers the men at Harvard that were lost in the World War and so on, my classmates.
So what should the new president be doing when not raising money? Fentress Driscoll wants him, or her, to be more visible to students than Rudenstine has been. She says the next president
needs to be able to interact well with students on all levels, needs to be visible. People perceive Harvard to be the leading learning institution in the world, but the average student doesn't feel that way. They feel that Harvard is a very hard place, it's a very cold place.
The search committee's list of qualifications for the presidency doesn't include getting to know the students. But one of its members, Hannah H. Gray, was quoted in the New York Times as saying that the president should be someone who can deal with the assimilation of the new information technologies and the questions that come out of the very rapid growth of scientific discovery. Keeping up with science has always played a big part at Harvard. One of its graduates is James Watson, class of 1962, who described the structure of DNA. But I'm a computer illiterate, and this emphasis on the necessity to assimilate the new technologies made me a little nervous. I thought Professor Gomes could shed some wisdom on the subject. The walls of his office in the basement of Memorial Church are covered with portraits of wise-looking prelates in white wigs.
Behind you is Andrew Preston Peabody, who is the second Plummer Professor of Christian Morals. The most interesting portrait in the room is that one of George Whitefield, who is not a predecessor, but was the 18th century Billy Graham, essentially. It said he could make grown men weep by pronouncing Mesopotamia. So these are all my ghosts.
I asked Professor Gomes if a Harvard president had to be steeped in information technology. Couldn't the subject be left to MIT?
I rather like that. It may not be left to MIT, but certainly we could hire somebody to deal with that. It seems to me we're not hiring the technician in chief. We ought to have somebody with some passion and some ideas, maybe somebody a little eccentric. But if that's the job description that's floating around the corporation, I will say even more prayers than I'm saying now, that they don't get that kind of a person. We don't need that here.
Harvard graduates include people like Ralph Waldo Emerson, class of 1826, and Henry David Thoreau, class of 1834. So I wondered if the new president could bring a kind of spiritual quality to the fast-moving Harvard of today, not necessarily from the pulpit, as was the earliest tradition of Harvard presidents.
I don't know as I think the president himself needs to be religious, though I do think it is important for the president to be able to believe in something other than himself and other than Harvard. And religion tends to be the thing that helps you do that. It gives you some perspective that goes beyond this place and this moment and this time.
Outside in Harvard Yard, students were pouring down the steps of the ugly old red brick Seaver Hall after classes. Long ago, I carried armfuls of books down those same steps. Whoever comes as president to watch over this huge, multifaceted university, I hope he will watch carefully over the Harvard experiences of these undergraduates who are so vulnerable in the rush of the electronic age. My journalist father, class of 1916, once wrote a few lines about his own Harvard awakening. His article was about his favorite English professor, Charles Townsend Copeland, and about the room in Hollis Hall where Copey goaded and inspired students for 28 years. That room contained, my father wrote, the relics of so much juvenile aspiration, so many first bouts with reality, so many sudden understandings of what makes some things shoddy and pretentious and second-rate, and others honest and restrained and true. For NPR News, I'm Alice Furlow in Cambridge, Massachusetts.